I'm Mark Hennick. This is So-Called Normal. Hey folks, welcome to A Little Normal. This is a short version of our So-Called Normal podcast. For these five episodes of this limited revival of the show, we've been talking to five really interesting, fascinating people that you probably have never heard of about their complex care pathways for treatment-resistant depression. It's been such an honor to me to be invited into their lives, to explore their stories, and to really figure out what the problem is, what the barriers are to getting people help, to getting people over the hump. And consistently, this is what we've been finding, that people do figure out a way through. I thought I was the only one who had to just figure it out through grit and grace, but there's a lot of people out there doing that too. So what we're doing on these off weeks, we're releasing those conversations every other week. What we're doing on these off weeks, a little normal, we've been calling it, bringing in Dave Trafford, who's been editing the episodes in the back there. Dave, thanks for coming on again to chat.
Yeah, good to join you.
So we've got Jen coming up next week. Jen, you know, really comes out strong talking about her anxiety from a very, very young age. And what really struck me, and I've got young kids, I've got three young kids, and one of them is a bit of an anxious kid. His temperament is just a bit more anxious than the other two are. And it really got me to thinking about how seriously do we take kids, period, but especially what kids feel. How, you know, without blowing everything up into some diagnosis of some kind, even if it is, or maybe it is, but how seriously do we really take kids' feelings?
Well, that even comes more to the point in this story, because you had to wonder how seriously the medical profession takes it, because I think at one point, you know, she was told, okay, well, look it up on Google.
Right. And Dr. Google, yeah.
That was her direction. It was never mind a prescription. It was, you know, well, you should look this up on Google to see what you should do about it. And yeah. And again, I think you make the point that the doctor at the other end, probably that's about as good as it was going to get, given the nature of the training and their exposure to these kinds of cases.
Yeah, you know, I've long had a real issue, and I think people have accused me in the past of being anti-medicine or anti-psychiatry or anything like that, and I'm not. I'm a very close ally of the healthcare profession, but I'm a critical ally too, in that, generally speaking, our first line of defense, the first piece of advice we give people who are experiencing any kind of what might be a mental health problem or illness is talk to your doctor. Sure, that's good advice. You should talk to your doctor. But the chances are, based on physician training, your doctor might not know what the hell to do, they have good experience, but they're probably not a psychiatrist if they're your family doctor. And it's not a coincidence that they're probably going to prescribe one of the same couple of medications that gets prescribed for everything, because that's the nature of mental health diagnosis and treatment. There is no test. We just prescribe a bunch of stuff, essentially, and see what happens. And that doesn't seem to be a very scientific approach.
And again, to sort of take the step back, understanding that these are all the best of intentions. I mean, when Jen made her first encounter with the doctor, her mom was there too. She was a young girl. So this was really family concern. Everybody was stepping up, seemed to think that they were all doing the right thing. And it turned into a rather longer journey for her than she would have wanted.
Well, and that's what frustrates me, I think, and one of the primary motivators for doing these last five episodes, including Jen's, is that everybody has great intentions. Everybody has, I think, probably both conscious and unconscious biases that play into this as well, parents and doctors included, that may present barriers to people. But I think that while everybody has great intentions, there's just no real clear pathway of, okay, how do we figure out what's going on here? How do we follow that through to actually address the problem? And then how do we resolve it? We're always one step behind the problem. We're always saying, okay, you're anxious, so here's this medication. Very rarely do we say, okay, you're anxious, let's get you into 12 weeks of cognitive behavioral therapy. We'll try to teach you some new coping mechanisms, and then we'll revisit and see if we need to do something else. I've actually never heard of that happening in the mainstream.
So is that because there's a sense on the part of the practitioner then that there's too much guessing going on? That they don't have an answer, that they don't want to be shown to have any kind of level of uncertainty here?
You know, that's a really good question. We should have Dr. Brian Goldman over at White Coat Black Art talks a lot about this idea of, you know, to call it physician ego maybe is a bit abrasive, because I don't think it's an insult by any means. But it's this idea that you don't want to be seen as not knowing something, that it seems to be very difficult, or at least I've noticed it's very difficult for medical professionals to admit that they don't know. But I think that's often the case here, that they do try to prescribe when we don't really know necessarily what's going on. And really, physicians, primary care physicians anyway, aren't always the most qualified person to figure out what's going on. They're highly qualified in a lot of things, but not necessarily in figuring out the thought distortions, for example, or the organization of somebody's life. This is why we need to bring in psychologists. To be a psychologist in Canada, at least, and elsewhere, you need to have a PhD level training in psychology. You wouldn't expect a family doctor to have 8 years or more of psychology training, because that's not their job. It's like you're sending somebody to a mechanic in order to address what's going on with their golf game. I just don't, it just doesn't seem like an appropriate match to me.
So here we are, though, we're, you know, heading into phase two of, and then the second wave, it clearly, whatever we are in that, in the COVID pandemic. And you and I have talked a lot over the last 6 months about the levels of anxiety, the intensity of the anxiety, at least. And there are a lot of people out there listening right now, going about their lives, experiencing it for the first time in their lives. And as we've gone through this, I have suggested that this needs to be, the pandemic needs to be a time of learning, because we have found so many problems in our systems, institutions, whether it was long-term health, long-term care facilities, the healthcare services itself, education is posing obviously its own problems. What is it that we should first and foremost be learning from the pandemic experience and taking that as an opportunity to make improvements?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. I've been thinking a lot about this. I have social anxiety disorder. I've had it since, you know, I was 12 years old. And one of the reasons that we talk about Jen, who focuses a lot on her anxiety, but also some other issues as well, is that anxiety is very often comorbid or co-diagnosed with a number of other issues. Now, during the course of the pandemic, you might not be experiencing diagnostic levels of anxiety, but there's actually a really good chance that you might, because one of the things we know about anxiety is that it's learned, that it's best treated through psychotherapy, which tells us that it's more of a learned style of thinking. It's a way of avoiding fears, for example. And my concern with the pandemic is that now, 6 months into it, or actually more than 6 months into it now, that's more than enough time to learn how to be anxious, to learn how to be afraid of leaving the house, for example, and getting infected with something. Or, you know, I just had my very first flight since December, I think, and I had to go to Quebec, which is the only province in Canada that has more daily positive COVID cases than Ontario. And I'm anxious about that. And I know that I'll probably be okay. I'm taking all the right precautions, but there's still that little kernel of what if I'm not. And I think that a lot of people are experiencing that now. And my concern is that, and actually, I think we're already in it, that the way that anxiety disorders work will overgeneralize, that it'll eventually start to apply to other things as well. You know, I can't go to work because I'm too anxious. Right. I can't connect with my friends because I'm too anxious. Then that isolation leads to depression, and it snowballs and snowballs. I think we're just at the cusp. We're just starting to go over the hill of this next wave of mental health problems and illnesses that are coming. And that's exactly why.
So, okay, but let's not go over the hill here. How do we sort of slow that rock down, if you will, and say, here, this is coming. Now, given the circumstance, here's what we have the opportunity to do. timidity.
This is where, yeah. So recovery is learned before you need it, before you need to recover, before you go over the hill or into the pit or whatever the analogy is. Mm-hmm. So this is really where, and this is what I had to learn. I use this idea all the time, and we heard it from all five guests so far, this idea that you just need grit, and grit isn't a coping strategy. Grit isn't the way that a mental health system should work, but the mental health system is broken, or at least was never built well to begin with, in Canada, the United States, and elsewhere. So people in recovery or struggling to recover or anticipating that they might need to recover really have no other choice but to figure it out often on their own, or a community of us figure it out together. And what that means is that, for me anyway, in terms of preventative measures, you need to be able to look for skills, look for opportunities to learn skills that are going to help you down the road. So learning mindfulness now, for example, learning CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. You can go on the, I've started doing this myself, even though I've done therapy for years. Go on the Beck Institute, rather, the founders of cognitive behavioral therapy. And you can take courses there. Anybody can do it. Take courses in cognitive behavioral therapy. Learn about your thinking and the connection between your thoughts, your feelings, and your actions. Because if you learn these things when you're well, before you go over the edge, it's much more likely you'll use those skills later when you need them.
I know we don't want to spend too much time here, but what you've just said begs a question for me. And I wonder, you know, against the backdrop of long-term care, and I talked to a number of experts who were deeply involved in that field, and I said, can you fix it? And they said, no. You can't fix long-term care. You've got to rebuild it. You got to break it and start all over again. And I wonder if in the case of the mental health sector, that it's even probably more complicated because it's not fixable because we never built it right in the first place. But the second thing is, the reason we didn't build it right in the first place is because ingrained in the system is a level of, there's bias there. There's a certain level of stigma attached mm-hmm. that's systemic within the system itself. It's not that, you know, I'm looking at somebody with the mental health issues and stigmatizing them. The system itself stigmatizes.
I think that's absolutely true. You know, we talk all the time about fixing the system, and then we call for the government to put more money in, which, yes, I'm a big supporter of the government better funding mental health. There's no question that mental health services are still dramatically underfunded. Even if you just do a basic return on investment analysis, or you do a basic, if we put the money into mental health versus almost anywhere else, it's better served in mental health. Even if you do all that stuff. Generally speaking, the mental health dollars are spent on the same broken system. It's spent on chasing the dragon, on lining up ambulances at the bottom of the bridge, on emergency care facilities, on more hospital beds, on essentially elaborating the institutional care system that didn't work 40 or 50 years ago. There's a reason why we dismantled the old mental health system of just institutionalizing people for the rest of their life, because it didn't work. But I think that we still have the remnants of that. We still have we're still haunted by the memory of that whole system. And the only way we can better serve people with mental health problems and illnesses around the world is to start from scratch, to build a system that is properly comprehensive and meets the needs not only of their brain, but of their mind too.
Yeah, well, that takes courage and commitment. So here's hoping that we're not in short stock of those moving forward.
I don't think we are. We just need to highlight and share the mic with the people who have it. So, mm-hmm. Dave, thank you so much for joining me for A Little Normal to talk about the episode that we have coming up with Jen next week. Folks can subscribe to the show, to So-Called Normal, on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube, everywhere else. You can find us everywhere. You can follow me on social media at Mark Hennick, at MarkHennick. I share the episodes every single week. And follow me for other, you know, if you ever want to have your feed flooded with mental health commentary and random observations about life. That's it. Dave, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Mark.
Take care.
This episode of So-Called Normal is brought to you by an educational grant from Janssen Inc. Mark Hennick and the producers of So-Called Normal are solely responsible for the content of the episode, and the views and opinions expressed in this episode do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Janssen Inc. The podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition, product, or treatment. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have read or seen in this podcast episode.